Mea Culpa from My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, David Byrne and Brian Eno, done in the background of many other Talking Heads-related projects and a real, genuine, artistic achievement, I think. I love that album because it's all at once so completely groovy and artistic and then just, intellectually inspiring, and the kinds of things that they're doing with things they basically found on late night radio and recorded and turned into that stuff. Then they had to chase everyone up and get them to sign a release and pay them off to be able to use their. Could you imagine you're a late night minister and you've given a sermon, mea culpa. I made a mistake. I know I've made a mistake. Like some record company calls you up and says, hey, we'd like to put this on this new concept album. Anyway, all right. So here we are in Tantra Studio. I haven't done it for a while. I just haven't had the energy, the bandwidth to focus my mind on this sensitive subject, recognizing how much pain and injury are innate in our society and how many people and many of my listeners. But it is Masturbation Month that has inspired me to speak up and to resume this. And I have I've committed to doing 4 programs, one every Friday during Masturbation Month. Now, what is Masturbation Month? It was not declared by President Biden or Trump or Obama or anyone like that. It was a concept cooked up by the women-centered sex toy stores. I am pretty sure that it was Good Vibrations in San Francisco that came up with the idea, probably soon after, aided and abetted by Babes in Toyland, now called Babeland in Seattle, it's coming back to me now. It is a creature of the 1990s. When there was so much fear being spread about sex and sexuality owing to this thing they were terrorizing us with called AIDS and the human immunodeficiency virus that no one has ever seen or have a sample of. And in response to that, one of the things that happened, and it was a beautiful thing, and I got to be part of it a little bit later on, a couple of years later, was that there was a sudden and exciting interest in masturbation, particularly in the form of group masturbation experiences that were sometimes called Jack and Jill offs or masturbation orgies or that kind of thing. And that's cool. It's a cool way to relate sexually. It is a fun way. I've done quite a few of them. A fun way to relate sexually and behavior very closely related to bonobo chimpanzees who use collective masturbation to work out their stuff and have fun and communicate and relate to one another. And we're a lot closer to bonobo chimps. I'm not sure they're chimps. I never can get that straight, but bonobos, let's just leave that part out, than we are to almost anything else. And so it's what I call normal primate behavior. When I'm having to explain this to a partner or a girlfriend and why I hold myself free to masturbate with anyone that I want or by myself at any time that I want, it's not that I'm like masturbating constantly. It's just a freedom that I reserve for myself, and then in particular sharing masturbation as a choice with someone. I just explain this as normal primate behavior. And over the years, I have spent quite a bit of thought and energy and writing bandwidth exploring the topic and also exploring why it is such a controversial issue. And that's actually not that hard to peel back and get to the bottom of. And I would remind you that it is a subset of sex in general, And the entire sexual conversation is fraught with the concept of sin perpetuated, as far as I understand history, exclusively at its inception by the Roman Catholics. The very, very early followers, supposedly, of Jesus and the Church of St. Peter. And they would do things like attempt to recruit women away from their husbands to be celibate nuns. And when you read this history, and it is best told in a book called Eros Denied by Wayland Young, easily found for a few dollars in used book search. I love this book so much that I have at times bought 10 or 20 copies and given one to everyone I know. It is just an excellent analysis of forbidden words, forbidden people, forbidden activities, and it explains elegantly how it happened that sex became a thing that we could not depict, think about, or talk about without creating a controversy. And masturbation, as I understand it, and there is a very good book called, I believe, Solitary Sex by Thomas Lacker. That's another one that I got a box of and gave out copies, in case anyone's wondering what I do when I have extra money, is spread ideas, as I'm doing right now. This topic was not an issue until the early 18th century, by which I mean no one really worried much about it. No one made it a thing. And then, all of a sudden, one day, around 1712, there is a book published called Onania, written by kind of a quack. It's very unlikely that it's his name, Dr. John Martin. So it's highly improbable he was an actual medical doctor. He was Dr. John Martin, I guess, in the same way that Doc Martin boots, whatever, maybe there may even have been an actual podiatrist behind the development of Doc Martin boots. I would imagine they have a better medical pedigree than Onania. But what Onania makes masturbation a thing, a point of focus, a point of figure, rather than as a thing lingering in the background, like, you know, scratching your head or blowing your nose, other bodily functions. And it points to it as a medical disease and a moral blight all in one, both of which must be cured. And it was getting this understanding that clued me into when something is a medical issue that is also made into a moral issue as a warning that there is some kind of a scheme or campaign or some other deceptive thing going on. And by the way, I mean, if you're not recognizing the intersection of the moral and the medical, that's what they pulled on us with COVID. They said, this is a medical issue, but you're a bad person if you don't cover your face because you're going to kill someone. None of that, of course, was even meekly true. So Thomas Lacker deconstructs this book, Onania, by Dr. John Martin, and what you get is this, well, almost pornographic tome, which is the first place documented where the story of Onan from the Old Testament is conflated with masturbation. Masturbation is even called Onanism, and It is thought to be synonymous with self-obsession, onanistic, and all this stuff. Well, no, it was birth control. Onan pulled out. He was fucking his brother's wife or something and didn't want her to get pregnant, so he spilled his seed on the ground. And then this one line becomes the entire basis for the moralizing of masturbation. And mind you, this is in the 18th century at that late hour. So it's not like there's some long history of controversy around masturbation. But of course, what happened in 1712, here 300 years later, seems like it's been around forever. But as far as I understand it, no one really cared. The only place you see it that I know of in Greek mythology is the god Pan, source of the word panic, taught humanity to masturbate. They account for its existence, but there's no moralism around it. But Pan was also the figure who was responsible for sounds in the forest at night that were, you know, said to be Pan roaming around. Well, Pan is really the green man of spring. He's this kind of expression of the vital force, and he is an entirely natural being. And so it is in this recent time, just a little over 300 years ago, that masturbation is first made a thing. It is defined as a specific issue. And then it is said to be a moral problem and a disease. Now, I don't have a sample of Onania to read you. I've read quotes of it in Tom Lacker's book, but I have a later thing that I would say, based on the typesetting and the style of English and all of this, is going to be a 19th century work, and it reflects something of this viewpoint. And the book it's from is called Satan in Society. And by the way, sex, and in particular guilt around sex, were the primary marketing device of the Catholics in terms of proving that people were sinners, and the fact that they were made to feel guilty made them feel guilty, and then the guilt was used as evidence that they were wrong. So it was, in a sense, self-validating. And this has created problems from which we have not recovered. And I'm going to get into the recovery in a bit, but I first want to read from you from this delightful chapter called Satan in Society, Chapter 4, Female Masturbation. Alas, that such a term is possible. Oh, that it were as infrequent as it is monstrous, and that no stern necessity compelled us to make the startling disclosures which this chapter must contain. It's pretty good. We're going to find out how bad this is. We beseech. I always think we beseecheth thee. We beseech in advance that every young creature into whose hands this book may chance to fall, if she yet be pure and innocent, these are Catholic concepts, pure and innocent, will at least pass over this chapter, that she may still believe in the general chastity of her sex, that she may not know of the depths of degradation into which it is possible to fall. We concede that only widespread existence of the crime could justify this public description of its consequences. We believe that a smaller proportion of girls than of boys are addicted to it, but the number is nevertheless enormous, and the dangers are all the greater that their very existence is so generally ignored, it's worse because we don't pay attention to it. Every tolerable physician, even tolerable physicians, seem oblivious to its prevalence and blindly go on in vain endeavor to heal maladies of the origin of which they are ignorant and to which the causes are in perpetual operation, i.e. they're claiming masturbation makes people sick and doctors haven't figured out how it is that people are getting sick. They're looking at the wrong thing. Beyond all dispute, the crime exists, and incontestably, the female boarding school is the area wherein it is most widely acquired and practiced. The female boarding school. We translate the following from an acknowledged high medical authority, Dictionnaire des Sciences Médicales. It's a French medical. It sounds good, right? Dictionnaire des Sciences Médicales. Instead of saying medical dictionary. Naturally, more timid and more secret than boys, the effects of their reunion, although very fatal, are less in the latter. This is not that easy to read. At the same time, a culpable negligence of the boarding schools of young ladies too frequently allows them to be introduced to the disorders of masturbation. The practice is dissembled from the impenetrative or careless eyes of the teacher under the guise of friendship, which is carried in a great number of cases to scandalous intent. The most intimate liaisons are formed under this specious pretext of friendship. The same bed often receives two friends, and then the paragraph ends, dot, 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 dot. This is fabulous porno. Two young women crawl into bed, no one else is around, they take off their clothes, and they masturbate together. It's going to convince us that this is the worst thing that ever happened. Okay, let's keep going. We have often seen letters from these young persons to each other, scarcely 11 or 12 years of age, the burning and passionate expressions of which made us shudder. The clandestine reading of certain books in which abject authors have traced in the liveliest colors the deplorable deviations of the senses is another no less fatal circumstances which hastens the corruption of girls. The syntax is all over the place, so if the sentence doesn't finally, you know, add up to one, it just the meaning comes across. One can affirm this reading of romances, romance novels, reading of romances which so easily becomes the object of veritable passion with young persons is today one of the most active causes of their deprivation. So they're reading romance novels and masturbating to basically to porno literature which describes sex, and then they're getting off, and then this is like the worst thing in the world. With them, as with boys, the genital organs may be continuously endowed with excessive predominance of action, which masters all of the affections, all of the movements of the economy, all causes them to titillate incessantly that part of these organs, which is the seat of the keenest sensibility. I think the clit. That's a long way to say clit. Yeah. Clitoris. Very, very little girls are often borne along by a kind of instinct to commit masturbation. The famous Dr. DeLandis makes the astounding statement, which can only be true of the French nation, that, quote, a great number of little girls and a majority of adolescents commit this crime, close quote. I think I've really got to read this. Yes. And is this more fun than the Supreme Court decision that I had to read 2 days ago? Human nature, however, is much the same the world over, and habit may be easily acquired and practiced, so little suspected or entirely ignored, and which these certain physical reasons girls are even more liable to contract than boys may well excite astonishment and alarm and render the distinguished Frenchman's caution equally appropriate here, quote, "There is no young girl who should not be considered as already addicted or liable to become addicted to this habit. It is often," close quote, it is often difficult, almost impossible, in fact, for the physician to ascertain the origin of many of the diseases of unmarried women which he's called upon to treat, and which, if the cause be perpetually in operation, he will prescribe with fruitless results. So he's saying again, this causes disease, but the doctor doesn't understand the cause of the disease. The broken health, the prostration, the great debility, the remarkable derangements of gastric and uterine functions for which the physician is consulted too often have this origin. When the cause is investigated, the subject alleges great exertions, intense trouble, unhappiness, etc., but is silent as to the real cause, which perhaps, after all, she does not herself associate with her maladies. The utmost penetration of the physician can only cause him to suspect the truth, but a question skillfully put will generally reveal all. Reveal all. This goes on and on and on and on and on. And this is, by the way, lifted straight out of Onania. Now, and then let's see what else here. After this, trust women, trust nurses, trust governesses, believe mothers. The symptoms which enable us to recognize or suspect this crime are following: a general condition of languor, weakness, and loss of flesh, the absence of freshness and beauty, the color from the complexion, of the vermilion from the lips, of whiteness from the teeth, which are replaced by pale, lean, puffy, flabby, livid physiognomy, the bluish circle around the eyes, which are sunken, dull, and spiritless, a sad expression, a dry cough, oppression and panting on the least exertion, the appearance of incipient consumption, the disease consumption, not like eating potato chips, the menstrual periods often exist at least in the commencement, but so the alteration of health cannot be attributed to their derangement or suppression. It is not uncommon to see the shape impaired or even deformed. So it's saying it turns your teeth brown and puts lines under your eyes and your lips, the color goes out of your lips, and your complexion is bad, but the moral symptoms are similar to those in the opposite sex, on and on and on and on and on. So what they're doing is they're attributing disease, all of these different forms of not feeling good, not seeming to look right, to masturbation. Now we can hear this today and think this is completely laughable. But I'll tell you, it was taken as seriously as COVID was, the most recent moral medical contrivance. Was in many places a big deal. Most of it, I would imagine, middle and upper class, not the hoi polloi, not the ordinary people, but those who are, first of all, reading this stuff as something other than porno. What you learn from reading Thomas Lacker's book is that Onania was essentially considered high literature, being read in the drawing rooms of the upper class, translated into numerous languages by the end of the 18th century, and being read as pornography on Grub Street, this now non-existent place in England. And so it served a dual purpose. In the poor, it was porno. And in the rich, it was some kind of a moral guide. And it was so seriously taken that Lacker documents Immanuel Kant by the early 1800s, saying that the great philosopher Immanuel Kant, that masturbation is so horrendous, there should not even be a word for it. And what are we really talking about here, right? What do everyone knows what masturbation is. And it is basically destroyed in a moral context where there is absolutely no basis for the moral problem, because it's not harming anyone. But what it is doing is what it always has done, which is to teach self-awareness. Masturbation, consciously practiced, leads to self-awareness, and it leads to an awakening of the sexual senses. It is a very free experience when you're doing it freely, and I think many people get there, at least for a little while. And I've often pondered why there is such a fuss and a controversy, you know, over this, even in many places to the present day. And apart from saying, well, this controversy was started by an idea, by a kind of a meme that was claimed to be on authority of a medical doctor. It was claimed to be on medical authority that we all had to stop and take note and buy a medication. Onanya offered a medication to cure this moral blight and medical disease, a kind of snake oil product. Well, you can get injected, basically. And that's, I can imagine that coming up soon on a cable channel near you. So this whole disaster goes unanswered for centuries. But Freud addresses the topic, and he attempts to be enlightened about it by making a distinction between a clitoral and a vaginal orgasm. Now, I guess he's doing this like in the early 1900s. Let's get Freud's dates. Freud lives from 1856 to 1939. So this is what I view as one of the great windows of fallacy, where so much horseshit peddled as science entered consciousness and was published and taken seriously. And so, in a sense, Freud is the first person to openly answer Onanya. And he does so in the form of saying that the clitoral orgasm, which is generally a masturbation orgasm, is the immature, girlish orgasm. He doesn't say that it's immoral. He says that it's immature, and that the true true womanly orgasm is the vaginal orgasm. Now, I cannot imagine that Sigmund Freud ever got close enough to a pussy to ever actually figure this out for himself. I can't imagine. Just can't bring myself there. I try. I can't imagine him being curious enough or liking women enough or being sexually turned on himself. And if you've read a book called The Function of the Orgasm, which I've been nudging my friends to read for many years, and many have, we find out from The Function of the Orgasm, which is by Wilhelm Reich, who is a student of Freud, who split from Freud because Freud essentially modified his entire psychoanalytic theory from a sex-based theory of what drives consciousness to a death-based theory. from Eros to Thanatos. And he did this along with other members of the psychoanalytic group because the Nazis were sexual purists. They did not want any discussion or consciousness of sex. The sex books were burned. They were on the list of banned books. The Nazis did a lot of banning ideas. So you think, well, what's the big deal? But you're burning books, it means you're banning ideas. And every totalitarian regime has this as one of its central features. And in the Nazis were particularly vicious toward sexual consciousness. So Freud flips his entire script, and then this percolates through the psychiatry, you know, profession, and then it is picked up by the psychology profession, which is kind of the little brother of psychiatry, and then therapy, and this anti-sex dogma is injected into the psychic healing modalities, the psychological healing modalities by the Nazis. But one person resists this, and that person is Wilhelm Reich. Now, Wilhelm Reich doesn't have much to say about masturbation. He has a lot to say about the necessity of, you know, genital contact and all this, and full gratification of male and female sexuality. Like, he was a product of his times. He was not talking about homosexuality at all. It kind of doesn't really exist that I've read much. And I'll ask Tom DiFerdinando that. But Reich is preaching the dogma of the necessity of fully expressed genital sex between men and women. So he's pro-sex. He is all about the orgasm. But there's still not advocacy for masturbation or much acknowledgement of it. So it's still lingering in the background as a point of, it's hard to say exactly what this is. So then next we have Kinsey. This is a very summarized version of events. And if someone finds me in error, please let me know. But when I was working with someone whose name I'm going to mention or talk more about in a minute, Betty Dawson, I did a lot of research and constructing this timeline and this basic, you know, pedigree of like how we got here. So the Kinsey reports come out like in, I think, 48 and 50. Let's see. Yeah, 48 and 53, the diversity of sexual orientation, the Kinsey Institute. There's the 43 is the male and 13% of females. That's interesting. Let me click on this website. So the first ever sexological study, which is based on surveys, it's based on interviews, comes out in 48, the male version, and then in 53, the female version. This is by an entomologist. Kinsey is not like a psychiatrist or any form of a sexologist. There really isn't sexology at this point, but he becomes curious about this natural thing and why there's so much controversy, and he wants to know what people really do. And what they find out is that people do, in fact, masturbate. That was the big news. And one nice thing about Kinsey is he's not judging the behavior. But they find out things like 37% of males and 13% of females had at least one overt homosexual experience to orgasm. I think that may have changed. I mean, that may have reversed now. 10% of males were more or less exclusively homosexual, and 8% of males were exclusively homosexual for at least 3 years between the ages of 16 and 55. For females, Kinsey reported a range of 2-6% for more or less exclusively homosexual experience. 4% of males and 1.1-3% of females had been exclusively homosexual after the onset of adolescence up to the time of the interview. And he invents the Kinsey scale. So it's Kinsey who says, oh, by the way, there's not just heterosexuality. There's not just homosexuality. There is this gradation between one and the other. Now, most people know that, you know, there's gayer than gay people, and then there's straighter than straight people, and pretty much everyone is somewhere in between. Everyone else is somewhere in between. Okay, so Kinsey, I don't have his numbers on masturbation. I can probably dig that out. But he acknowledges that it exists. The shocking thing about Kinsey is basically he acknowledges that sex exists. And he finds out that people tend to lie about it a lot. But let's stick to masturbation. So then next is Masters and Johnson. So Masters and Johnson also, they acknowledge the existence of masturbation, but they don't have anything special to say about it. They're not particularly advocating it. It's just sort of in the background. It's not in the foreground. And it's not until Betty Dodson wakes up, an artist. She was an artist. You know, she starts as a commercial artist. She's a very, very fine artist also. But she's working as a commercial artist. And she wakes up in her marriage, realize she's not happy in her marriage and she's not sexually happy in her marriage. And it is the 60s after all. And I'm not sure what year of her divorce. I don't have a chronology of her life handy, and I never made one with her. But she is the first person to focus the topic of masturbation. She focuses the topic of female masturbation, and she wakes up to the body as a creature of beauty, not merely as an anatomical and physiological device. And as she tells the story, and there's wonderful discussions of this, and my favorite video of hers is My Life of Art and Sex by Betty Dodson. It's a talk she gave in Seattle. It's one of the funniest things I've ever heard. I was listening with a friend one night, and we smoked a little weed before we listened, and she was so funny that we had to stop the thing every 5 minutes or so to get control of ourselves long enough to focus to focus on the next thing she said. And she didn't think she was that funny. She didn't think it was that funny. I thought it was freaking hilarious. And it's just kind of her acerbic wit and her kind of critique of everyone and everything. But the point is that in the 60s, Betty starts getting women together to masturbate together. And this starts when she's giving a lecture on orgasm in front of some feminist, like women's lecture somewhere. Because there were a lot of consciousness-raising groups at the time. And someone said, what does an orgasm feel like? And this is a kind of a famous story. And far as I know, it is actually true, because I've heard it from Betty, that she tried to describe an orgasm, but then she said, look, it's going to be easier if I show you. Does anyone mind? And she whipped out her vibrator. They said, sure, fine. She takes off her clothes. She sits on the table in this lecture room and masturbates to orgasm in front of everyone. And this got her started, and she invents these things called body sex groups. And essentially, they ran monthly at least, but for decades, clear to the end of 2019, they ran monthly for like 50, 60 years. And she did one-on-one coaching sessions and so forth. And then she is commissioned by Ms. Magazine. Like the feminist movement in that era was not very pro-sex. They were busy politicizing sex, like the gay movement. It was seen as a political topic, but not as a an aesthetic topic or is it a source of fun and pleasure and beauty? And Betty is illustrating it. She's illustrating all forms of sex, and she's illustrating pussies. This is really her specialty, is the infinite variety of kinds of pussies that there are. Betty has basically seen them all. She's probably seen more pussies than like anyone except maybe a gynecologist who worked for 70 years and didn't see them at their best. Saw them under clinical conditions with a speculum shoved up inside of them in stirrups. That's not very much fun. Betty got the fun side of all the pussies. And she writes an article. She's commissioned to write an article for Ms. Magazine about masturbation. Ms. Magazine, famous feminist magazine. And Betty is part of the feminist movement, but she's really one of the only, that I know of, the only actual outspoken, vocal advocate for masturbation, in particular female masturbation. It's just not a thing. Like no one is like, it's challenging. But the thing to make it like to focus this topic in a positive way, but by my analysis of history, Betty is the first person to really answer Dr. John Martin, who wrote this O Nanya book and is either part of or spawns this vast genre of anti-masturbation literature that just goes on and 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 on endlessly, endlessly. And so Betty, she said that the editors took her through like 10 drafts of this article in Ms. Magazine, and by the time it was done, it was a confession. And they said to her, oh, by the way, would you like offer something so we can get a sense of how the readers are taking this information in? Charged $5 for something. And she's like, okay, they put an announcement in for $5, we'll send you something. And she didn't have anything to send them. And what happened was that a lot of $5 checks came in. The $5 checks came flooding in, and Betty didn't even have a bank account at the time. This is, you could live, can you imagine? You could live in a big city without a bank account because everything was transacted in cash. And she had to open a bank account, and she had to write this book called Liberating Masturbation. Now, I had a copy of the first edition. She gave me a copy, and it was lifted from my home by someone out of my collection. I never lent it out. It's not there. And then a reader, who I don't remember who it is, apologies, sent me a very early, like, second rendering of Liberating Masturbation with the new name Self-Love and Orgasm. Much more nicely printed and presented. And this book kept evolving along with her work and along with her art, and has been translated into many, many languages, and she estimated it had sold 1 million copies in all of its various different forms and pamphlets and handmade, you know, home published versions, and then picked up by major publishers along the way. She is the first person to answer Dr. John Martin, and in one of our last conversations in person, I said to her, I figured out that you were really the only revolutionary thing about the sexual revolution, which is really not much of a revolution. There was a lot of sexual expression going on, but what was the revolution? The revolution is Betty is saying, well, your sexual relationship with yourself is the most important sexual relationship that you will ever have, and that it's the center of everything. And the way I put it is that your sexual relationship with yourself is the thing that you bring into all of your other sexual relationships, whether or not you know your body, how you feel about yourself, how you feel about your orgasm, what your thoughts and feelings and desires are. All of this, it centers around masturbation. And yet, masturbation is still, thanks to Dr. John Martin and then a diversity of other people who followed in his footsteps and then took the whole thing too damn seriously, and great intellects, the like of Immanuel Kant, saying this thing is so abominable there shouldn't even be a word for it. Well, that is a very strong sentiment, and he was a kind of an influencer, to say the least, of his time, but also reflective of the attitudes and values of his period of history. And then comes all this puritanical Victorianism and this whole pretense of purity. And then we enter the 20th century, which Victorian is late, includes early 20th century. We enter the 20th century with this kind of moralistic thing going on, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse. And then finally, Betty is the first person to refocus the topic as a positive thing, as a thing connected with self-actualization, connected with growth, connected with self-understanding, connected with spiritual becoming, associated with bonding and camaraderie. Betty incorporates, inaugurates, makes real masturbation as a social activity, and also the open discussion of sex and sexuality as a normal social activity. And one of the things you learn from reading Eros Denied by Wayland Young, which comes out in 1964, right at the height of the Uranus-Pluto conjunction, or at the very, very beginning of it, is that the history of sex is the history of taking something that is just part of everyday life and turning it into a special category and making it something bad and attacking it. And so once that has happened, it's no longer a normal part of life. It's no longer something that people just do. And when you're there, you then have to refocus on it and say, okay, this is a normal thing that people just do. But we can, and I think that we must do that. So that is like the kind of nutshell version of the history of masturbation. I have given several ideas for books to read. Tom Lacker's great book. It's essential reading if you're interested in the subject. Eros Denied by Wayland Young. So let's end with some of Betty's words from this 1983 version, now 39-year-old version, of self-love and orgasm. Right, Betty associates masturbation with love, self-love. She associates it. She consecrates masturbation as an actual legitimate form of sex. Now, by the way, to get there, you need that idea, or it helps maybe to have that idea, but then there's a self-introspective journey about having it, your sexual relationship with yourself really being a sexual relationship. Okay, so let's see. Now, she starts her book with her romantic image of sex, and romanticism is one of the things that kills natural sexual exploration, because it's like starts with Adam and Eve, and then we're given this very narrow range of possibilities. That essentially sex always ends in marriage and in procreation, a very Catholic idea. So she talks about the movies of the 1940s giving me delicious close-ups of long, wet kisses, misty, sad eyes, thousands of darling I love yous, along with tearful embraces after painful separations. These were all images of romance. Hollywood did not supply images of sex. When it was time for actual sex, the scene was always faded and the camera zoomed in on a huge wave crashing against the rocks. I knew that was supposed to be the orgasm, and it made me long for passionate sex with my future, quote, perfect lover, unquote. Someday we would get married and live happily ever after. It was the romantic ideal that all young girls shared, so I was quite normal, except for one thing. While I was waiting, I was secretly enjoying orgasms with myself. And she talks about this. And remember, this is the book that was this book grew out of the pamphlet that was to be given out for $5 anyway, for Ms. Magazine to find out how many people reacted positively, since there was no likes and dislikes in that era. You had to put something in, say, send us something. In this case, it was send us $5. And she had a stack of these checks, and I think she said she sold 5,000 copies of Liberating Masturbation, each of which she personally hand-stapled. She said it was like the longest hand job she ever gave, pounding the stapler to staple thousands of copies of this book, and I had one of those hand-stapled copies with the pages in the wrong order. So she goes on and on here. So let's jump to the back. She talks about her... So she's relating to the feminist movement while this is going on. And she says they're having all these boring meetings using Robert's Rules of Order. She couldn't fucking stand it. She's a hedonist and a sensual person and an artist, like a true artist. It was completely boring to go to these meetings. And let's see. This is. Let's get to a juicy part. Well, I'm looking at all these pencil sketches of pussies. In 1973, I joined with other feminists to plan the Now Sexuality Conference in New York. During one of our early meetings, a friend asked, "What would you like to do for the plenary session?" Quite spontaneously, I answered, "I want to do a slideshow of split beaver for feminists so women can become cunt positive." She liked the word cunt. Betty never said vagina or vulva. It sounded too much like Volvo, and vagina is just the sheath inside. She's cunt, cunt, cunt. It was fun to... I don't have any recordings of Betty saying cunt, cunt, cunt. It would be fabulous to turn that into music. Maybe if I look hard enough, I'll find one. Several women there strongly objected to my use of the word cunt, and I explained that it happened to turn me on, and I intended to continue using it. That's Betty. In the conference flyer, it was called Creating an Aesthetic for Female Genitals, which was the academic way of saying becoming cunt positive. I didn't care what we called it as long as I got to do it. See, is this funny? I think Betty's really funny. I started calling friends and asking if they would like to pose for the first feminist pornography. This is the sexual revolution happening in the form of Betty Dodson. The response was positive, and about 20 women plus two women photographers met at my apartment. It was a fantastic gathering. The lights and camera were set up in the bedroom, and in the living room, the women talked while they trimmed and shaped their pubic hair in preparation for the photos. We took turns posing with our genitals in natural position, outer lips held open, and one exposing the clitoris. Then each of us, we've come a long way since Thomas Slack, since John Martin. Female masturbation, oh, that such a word is possible. You know, the women are all getting together, splitting their pussies, showing their clitorises off, and getting photographs so Betty can draw them, so the drawings can be put into slides and shown to a huge conference. Do you see what I'm saying? When I told Betty that she's the only revolutionary thing about the sexual revolution, that was from long study. And knowing her, I probably knew her for 24 years at that point. There were oohs and ahs and other comments. How beautiful. Look at that pretty mother-of-pearl texture. What exquisite coloring. Occasionally, there was a spontaneous round of applause as women displayed themselves artfully. We began to see designs, shapes, patterns, and associations with nature. A shell, a flower, a fig, an orchid, and yes, even those dangling wattles. I now think chickens are sexy. I saw styles emerging. There was the classical cunt with symmetry, the Baroque style with complex folds and drapery, the Gothic cunt with archways, the Danish modern with clean lines, and there were many Valentine cunts. We realized the heart design was the shape of women's genitals. Just flip the heart over, it's a vulva. When she held her vaginal lips open, you get another picture of the heart. St. Valentine's Day suddenly had new meaning. When the hood was pulled back and each clitoris appeared, the variations were astounding, ranging from tiny little seed pearls to rather large protruding phalluses. I had looked up phallus in the dictionary. It referred to both the penile glands and the clitoral glands. I did not know that. I must have read this. We were changing our image from female eunuch to phallic women. So, by the way, it's Betty who first basically breaks the gender barrier. She breaks the I'm a that or a that barrier. I'm hetero, I'm homo barrier. She's essentially the first philosophical gender bender. There were other people in her time, Lou Reed, Walk on the Wild Side, and there's other people doing this, but she's doing it in this very straightforward way, documenting and writing about it. It's not exactly scientific, but it is. Betty had a scientist streak to her, but it's a kind of a form of observational natural science, like bird watching. When the hood was pulled back, each clitoris appeared. The variations were astounding. We've read this. The phallic woman, the position of the clitoris in relationship to the vaginal opening varied. Some women had their clit close to the opening and said they had orgasms with intercourse. I thought I had discovered a new theory until a woman with the same configuration posed, and she said she always needed direct clitoral stimulation to have orgasms. Betty, a beautiful writer, by the way, a perfectionist, and she loved my writing. Another woman couldn't get her clitoris to pop out. She was convinced she didn't have one until she pressed her finger on either side of the clitoral shaft, and we could see the tip of her tiny clit, of her shy clit, excuse me. Technically called an embedded clitoris. It was difficult to see, but it was easy to feel and worked just fine. The vaginal opening wasn't a hole at all, but rather soft little pink folds that created different patterns within each woman. We became aware of the differences in pubic hair and genital coloring. Some women had dark, thick bushes, and others had fine, wispy hair. One woman shaved off her pubic hair. One woman shaved off her pubic hair, and she was our futuristic cunt, capital F, capital C. The form of her genitals was stark and beautiful. Other colors ranged from pale pink to dark brown. One woman had a two-tone cunt. Her inner lips were dark brown, surrounded by delicate peach. Another woman had very dark brown genitals and said her lover called her the Black Orchid. Throughout the evening, there was animated conversation. There were also moments of silence as each of us became lost in our own thoughts. Toward the end, I closed my eyes and saw one exquisite cunt after another pass before my mind's eye. For centuries, women had not had an image of their own genitals created by women. Now here it was, not the male version of pussies and beavers, but the women's version of the lotus flower unfolding for the new Aquarian age. I showed my slides to over 1,000 women at the Now Women's Sexuality Conference. I want to just say this again. She said, this is like 1973, I think. I showed the slides of her drawings. Maybe they were, well, she doesn't say she drew them. I think she's saying that they were photographs. She showed the photos to a plenary session of 1,000 women. There was a long, loud standing ovation as I stood there on the stage with goosebumps and thrills running up my spine. Afterward, many women gave me positive and enthusiastic feedback. Many told me they felt dramatically changed looking at the slides. Others said they, too, thought they were deformed. Betty thought she had ruined her pussy for masturbation. And her boyfriend, I will think of his name. We know that I'm terrible at thinking of names on the fly sometimes, unless they're like Monsanto executives. So he ran her website till he died around 1999. Several told me they felt dramatically changed by looking at the slides. Others said they too thought they were deformed. One woman said she'd asked her boss for a raise the next day and got it. Knowing her genitals were beautiful made her feel much more positive about herself. She felt she deserved more money. Not long after that, I read a letter in one of the popular magazines addressed to the doctor's column under the heading Large Vaginal Lips. A 20-year-old woman said she recently noticed her inner lips seemed to have gotten very large. She wanted to know if masturbating could have caused it and what should she do. The doctor answered that large inner lips are in part hereditary and, quote, if as part of your masturbating you pull the labia minora, you could stretch and lengthen them. If the labia are so enlarged as to trouble you or make you feel embarrassed to attempt intercourse, it's a relatively simple procedure to reduce the size, close quote. He recommends the doctor's office a little Novocaine, snip, snip, off come the offenders. I shall refrain from calling this doctor a dirty name and point out that he was not cunt positive. I'll say. Another offensive medical recommendation is the clitoridectomy, female circumcision. A friend of mine who was orgasmic with vibrator only longed to have orgasms from her lover's penis. She consulted her doctor, who told her that if some of the hood were removed from her clitoris, it might be more sensitive, allowing her to climax with intercourse. He only suggested the surgery might help. It was a simple office procedure, a little Novocaine and snip, snip. She had her circumcision and got an infection, which added 2 more weeks to the ordeal. When she recovered, she still couldn't reach orgasm with penetration alone. In my opinion, male or female, circumcision is an unnecessary surgical procedure. It's time, Betty says, to stop insisting on the romantic ideal of having all of your orgasms from Romeo's cock inside Juliet's cunt. If a woman can stimulate herself to orgasms, she is orgasmic. Frigid, in quotes, is a man's word for a woman who cannot have an orgasm in the missionary position in a few minutes with only the kind of stimulation that is good for him. We can stop clinging to the notion that we should have orgasms from intercourse alone. We must not be intimidated by doctors who still refer to coital inadequacy, quote, quote, in women when their own laboratory and statistical evidence clearly contradicts the male concept of female response. The truth is, few women consistently reach orgasm in intercourse without additional stimulation. We don't always have to come to enjoy intercourse, but I feel that any woman who is not achieving orgasm most of the time cannot possibly maintain a joyful attitude toward sex over an extended period of time. Both the interior and the exterior parts of our genitalia produce delicious sensations. Vaginal penetration is very erotic with fingers, a dildo, or a penis, especially when it's done with design and sensitivity. She's such a good writer. Some of the women prefer orgasms from penetration only. Others want direct clitoral stimulation during intercourse, and some women prefer oral sex. Then there are those women, like myself, who want it all. The entire body is an erogenous zone, and the mind is the master of eroticism. Becoming cunt positive is essential for learning to love our bodies ourselves. So this is all survives in the book Sex for One. It became Sex for One by Betty Dodson. You can probably pick it up for a nickel, or a dollar, or $10, or $25, brand new. She rewrote it. She's really a perfectionist. Rewrote it over and over again. But this is an early version. The writing is fucking gorgeous. And Grant Taylor is the man's name I was thinking of. Was the Betty's first relationship after her marriage. And she said to Grant, she thought she ruined her pussy from too much masturbation, because her inner labia were long. And Grant said, you got to be kidding me. Hold on. He went in his room and brought out a box of porno magazines, like not Penthouse and Playboy, but things like Hustler and like Split Beaver magazines. And Betty sat there the entire evening looking at picture after picture of the incredible, fabulous diversity of cunts, and was in a sense healed and awakened by porno. And then she went on to create numerous films and, you know, movies, documentaries, and lectures and talks and other things, and a website that went on for years and years, and was a pioneer. And so when you hear me say she was the first person to really answer Dr. John Martin, whoever he is, and whoever wrote this Satan in Society thing, directly, sincerely, not predominantly, not as a scientist at all, not as a social theorist, not as a critic, not as a religious person, but as artist, it is a photo project that she starts with. Cunt positive feminism. Can you imagine a room with 1,000 women where they're showing photo after photo of cunts on the screen? Today, this would be outrageous and scandalous and politically incorrect, and it reflects the utterly beyond repressed times in which we're living. Beyond repressed times in which we're living. And really, maybe I'm talking about in anywhere where there is a politicization of sex, but there's still all the romanticization of sex. And it's political here, it's romantic there, and it's perverse there and sinful there. And like where's the ground where there is some freedom? So like Betty, I think that there is an expression of this freedom in a website I wish I could show Betty and get her opinion of, called Chatterbait, which is this cam site where you can just go right on it, chatterbait.com. There's no login, registration, or anything. You can see it all. The problem is that it's not a group of women in a room hanging out together, making art together, which is then put onto slides and shown to a larger group of women in the room together responding. It's digital. It's people separated. There's no pheromones involved. They can't really cross the digital divide that I know of. So, where are we? I don't know. Let's keep exploring this. I'm very eager to hear from you. If you have any thoughts you want to share, just email me at efc@ericfrancis.com and tell me what you think about this. If you have ever encountered the work of Betty Dodson in any other way, and I'm going to link to a couple of her videos. I'm going to try to find her article for Ms. Magazine. We've preserved that on the Planet Waves website somewhere. I've got to figure out where. That's from back in the Anatoly days. And I'm very happy that I got to share this with you. So my commitment is to do 4 of these programs through Masturbation Month. So they'll be every Planet Waves FM, barring some unforeseen circumstance. And I'm very happy to have a place where I can even do it. This is Planet Waves FM, a beautiful place of not just free expression, but where you are free to indulge yourself in the ideas I'm sharing, and I'm very eager to hear back from you. Again, efc@ericfrancis.com. I'm recording this on Thursday night so that I could be on a fresh mind ahead of the rest of the show. So this is, as the last segment, I'm here to say thank you for listening and for your generous support of the program. We had a good month with donations in April. If we could keep that up, I could get paid to do this. So that would be wonderful. And so thank you to all who donated and who come back and listen to the program and find some sense of solace or companionship or entertainment here. All right, signing off. I have to tell you what the song we're going out with. According to the plan, that is going to be, oh wait, I had that a second ago. Here it is. Here's my set list. I've got to kind of read my handwriting. What else is new? We are still on Burn Eno. We'll do some other version of Eno next week. But this, we're going to go out with... I think it's number 8. My handwriting seems to say number 8, Glory. But I've confused that with Moonlight in Glory. So I think it's... track 17. There's number 17 is number 8 mix 17. No, that's two versions of 17. It is late. Anyway, from my life in the Bush of Ghosts, some really cool music. I love you dearly. Thank you for making this possible and for being my audience. All right. Bye for now.